log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
پیغمبر اعظم نمونه.
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
شدن بر اصحابشون بعد خطاب کردن به اصحاب ارتعوا فی ریاض الجنه.
One day the holy prophet of Islam came to his companions and stated, attend the gardens in heaven. The companions asked, what are the gardens of heavens? Then the prophet answered, the sessions and gatherings in which I, the Prophet of Allah, am remembered. This is a garden in heaven. Now, one of the blessings for Shia community are the gatherings and sessions which are held in remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt. The sessions and majalis for Imam al-Hussein and other infallibles, or the sessions during the month of Ramadan, are all indications of remembrance of holy men of Allah, and as a result, Allah Himself. The Holy Prophet of Islam also asked his companions to attend the remembrance sessions of Allah and Ahlul Bayt during all parts of the day and night and whenever they find a chance. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khalaf Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khalaf Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
America's 21st century wars have been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways, says Nick Terse, writer, in an article titled, On the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, is there any end in sight? Stay tuned, please, for the details. This is a different kind of war, which we will wage aggressively to disrupt and destroy terrorist activity, U.S. President George W. Bush announced a little more than 2 weeks after 9/11 attacks. Some victories will be won outside of the public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. Other victories will be clear to all. This year will mark the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, including America's undeclared conflict in Afghanistan. Despite neither a clear victory nor the slightest evidence that enduring freedom had ever been imposed on that country, U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan ended, according to the Defense Department in 2014. In reality, that combat simply continued under a new name, Operation Freedom's Sentinel, and grinds on to this very day. Like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, known as Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom and Freedom's Sentinel failed to live up to their names. Nor did any of the monikers slapped on America's post-9/11 wars ever catch the public imagination. The battlefields spread from Afghanistan and Iraq to Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, Syria, Niger, Burkina Faso, and beyond, at a price tag north of $6.4 trillion and a human toll that includes at least 335,000 civilians killed and at least 37 million displaced from their homes. Meanwhile, those long-promised clear victories never materialized, even as the number of terrorist groups around the world proliferated. what the future will bring in terms of this U.S. many armed conflicts is murkier than ever, as the Trump administration pursues an array of 11th-hour efforts interpreted as last-minute attempts to make good on pledges to end this country's endless wars, or simply as sour grapes shots at upending, undermining and sabotaging the deep state, the CIA in particular, while handcuffing or kneecapping the incoming Biden administration's future foreign policy. For 4 years, the Trump administration has waged a multi-front war, not only in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and elsewhere around the globe, but with the Pentagon as well. Donald Trump entered the White House vowing to stop America's ceaseless foreign interventions and repeatedly teased ending those endless wars. He didn't. Instead, he and his administration continued to wage America's many conflicts, surge troops into Afghanistan and Syria, and threaten nuclear strikes against enemies and allies alike. When the president finally began making halting gestures toward curtailing the country's endless conflicts and attempt to draw down troops in various war zones, the Pentagon and State Department slow walked, slow rolled, and stymied their commander-in-chief, deceiving him. For example, when it came to something as basic as the actual number of U.S. troops in Syria. Far from ending endless wars, President Trump escalated the most endless of them. The conflicts in Afghanistan and Somalia, where America has been intermittently involved since 1970s and 1990s, respectively. Airstrikes in Somalia have, for instance, skyrocketed under the Trump administration. From 2007 to 2017, the U.S. military conducted 42 declared air attacks in that country. Under President Trump, 37 strikes were conducted in 2017, 48 in 2018, and 63 in 2019. Last year, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, acknowledged 53 air strikes in Somalia, more than during the 16 years of administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The reasons for that increase remain shrouded in secrecy. The uptick in airstrikes has been disastrous for civilians. While Africa Command recently acknowledged 5 deaths of non-combatants in Somalia from all such airstrikes, an investigation by Amnesty International found that in just 9 of them, 21 civilians were killed and 11 others injured. According to the UK-based monitoring group, Air Wars, evidence suggests that as many as 13 Somali civilians have been killed by U.S. strikes in 2020 alone, and Trump's recent decision to withdraw U.S. forces from there will not end those air attacks, much less America's war, according to the Pentagon. While a change in force posture, this action is not a change in U.S. policy, reads a Defense Department statement that followed Trump's withdrawal order. The U.S. will retain the capability to conduct targeted counterterrorism operations in Somalia and collect early warnings and indicators regarding threats to the homeland. The war in Afghanistan has followed a similar trajectory under President Trump. Far from de-escalating the conflict, as it negotiated a peace deal with the Taliban and pursued troops withdrawal, the administration ramped up the war on multiple fronts, initially deploying more troops and increasing its use of U.S. air power. As in Somalia, civilians suffered mightily, according to a recent report by Netta Crawford of Brown University caused a war project. During its first year in office, the Trump administration relaxed the rules of engagement and escalated the air war in an effort to gain leverage at the bargaining table. In all, the unit killed at least 51 civilians in Afghanistan's Wardak province between December 2018 and December 2019. As Akhtar Mohammed Tahriri, the head of Wardak's provincial council, told Quality, "The Americans step on all the rules of war, human rights, all the things they said they'd bring to Afghanistan." After losing his bid for re-election in November, the U.S. president did issue a series of orders drawing down some troops from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Virtually all military personnel are to be withdrawn from Somalia. There, however, according to the Pentagon, some or all of those forces will simply be repositioned from Somalia into neighboring countries in order to allow cross-border operations, not to speak of continuing targeted counterterrorism operations in that country. This suggests that the long-running U.S. air war will continue uninterrupted. The same goes for other war zones where American troops are slated to remain, and no cessation of airstrikes have been announced. News reports indicated that the Department of Defense is reviewing its support for the CIA. The reason former and current administration and military officials told Defense One was to determine whether special operations forces should be diverted from the agency's counterterrorism operations to missions related to competition with Russia and China. The New York Times suggested, however, that the true response could be to make it difficult for the CIA to conduct operations in Afghanistan. The troop drawdowns and 11th-hour policy changes have been cast by pundits and national security establishment boosters as the spiteful final acts of a lame-duck president. Whatever they may be, they also represent a genuine opportunity for a president-elect who has voiced support for a shift in national security policy. Almost two decades after President George W. Bush launched a different kind of war, more than a decade after President Barack Obama entered the White House, promising to avoid stupid wars while promising to win the right war in Afghanistan, 6 months after President Trump committed to ending the era of endless wars, as President Bush put it in 2001, some victories will be won outside of public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. America's 21st century wars have instead been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways. Failed forever wars are, however, also a Joe Biden legacy. As a senator, he voted for that 2001 AUMF, the 2002 AUMF, and then seconded a president who expanded America's overseas interventions. And nothing in his personal history suggests that he will take the bold actions necessary to follow through on putting an end to America's overseas conflicts.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
A
Aqsal Jalaldi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today, throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zaid al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. This chapter speaks about how we are able to protect and preserve our body and keep it away from any harm, and the hurma, the prohibition of bringing about any kind of harm to our body. You know, when you do hit a particular age, it's going to be too late for you to be able to regret or say anything that would, you know, mean you were not observant of how it is that you needed to be at that particular time. And that's why there is the importance of how you are able to become more healthy. And I'm just going to be sharing a few points here, and then we will go off in our next episode to speak about what are the factors of sicknesses. So here, when we're talking about the factors of health, obviously you need to look into the issue of hygiene. As Sheikh Jawadi Amali is explaining here, you need to look at the issue of controlling your food intake and monitoring what it is that you are eating. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says to his son Al-Hasan, peace be upon him, أَلَا أُعَلِّمُكَ أَرْبَعَ خِصَالٍ تَسْتَغْنِي بِهَا عَنِ الطِّبِ. Let me teach you four things that if you were to learn them, it would suffice you from medicine. قَالَ بَلَى, Imam Hassan said, yes. قَالَ لَا تَجْلُسْ عَلَى الطَّعَامِ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ جَائِعٌ. Do not sit to eat something unless you are hungry. وَلَا تَقُمْ عَنِ الطَّعَامِ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ تَشْتَهِيهِ. And don't get up from eating, don't leave from eating, without you wanting to eat more. Which means, eat only when you're hungry, and while you are eating, stop with that desire to want to eat more. So don't, of course, overindulge yourself when you are eating. وجود المضغ, try to chew good, chew as much as you can. وإذا نمت فعرض نفسك على الخلاء, and when you are going to go to sleep, then make sure you go to the bathroom, go to the toilets. فعرض نفسك على الخلاء. فإذا استعملت هذا استغنيت عن ال. And if you were to do these things, then you would be in no need for medicine. And that's exactly why there are so many traditions that speak about qillatu ta'am, or you not eating excessively. Gluttony is one thing, and eating excessively is, of course, another thing. You might eat a lot, but you might not be a gluttonous person, you know, but that's why, you know, the one hadith says, you know, where if your only one and only concern is eating, then your value is that which you excrete, that which comes out of you. Another hadith here, hadith from Imam The Ma'soom says, "Man qalla ta'amuhu sahha badanuhu wa safa qalbuh." Someone who eats less will have a healthy body, and also here, important thing here, wa safa qalbuh, a pure heart. And that's why there's always the talk of excessive eating and qaswatul qalb, and having a hard heart, having a dark black heart. Too much eating leads to you having a hard dark heart. Now there are other things that will also make you healthy, whether it be those particular things that Imam Ali alayhi salam had spoke to with his son Imam Al-Mujtaba, or other things. Like for example, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, "Safiru tasuhu," travel and you will be healthy. So there's a recommendation of you traveling, seeing the world. Go out and move around. You know, don't stay confined to four walls or to your normal routine. Break the routine. Go travel somewhere and experience something. Go on an adventure. You know, that's not only good for your physical side, but also for your mental and spiritual side.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith, Sumu Tasuhu, and that's a very famous hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Staying awake, Qiyamul Layl Sahhatul Masahhatun Lil Badan, Masahhatul Badan. Staying up for Qiyamul Layl, for doing Tahajjud, for doing Salatul Layl, is also going to make your body healthy. Performing Hajj is going to make your body healthy. The hadith says, "Hujju wa'tamiru tasihhu ajsamakum." Subhanallah. You know, some people say, "Oh, I can't do it. My back is going to hurt me. I have this problem. I have that ache. I have this issue." No. Here the hadith is saying that in order for you to have a healthy body, travel. In order for you to have a healthy body, fast. In order for you to have a healthy body, do Salatul Layl. In order for you to have a healthy body, go and do your Hajj and also your Umrah. Another beautiful way of finishing off this particular part is Sukut. Imam Ali alayhi salam, silence, being quiet, not talking too much. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, As-Sukutu Salama. Sukut is health. You'll be healthy if you are going to be quiet. Of course, that's why ulama'ul akhlaq, when they do speak about the importance of taking out times of silence and not talking excessively, it's only in reference to excessive talking that is pointless, that is of no use, and you only talk at times of necessity, that you only talk something that is meaningful, something that will bring about, as Sheikh Jawadi Amuli here explains, spiritual happiness. Because at some times, he says, that things that you say might not only be detrimental and damaging to you, but can also be used against you by your enemy. And that being used against you by your enemy, Sheikh Jawadi here says, will, of course, lead to your health becoming in danger, lead to you falling into danger. Now, of course, we understand that we need to make sure that we rest enough, and that's something that we're going to be talking about in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahiri.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the US economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of families unable to buy food or pay their rent. We now present you an article written jointly by Christopher Rugeber and Alexander Olson. The piece is titled, Once Again, Job Losses Fall Unequally Across the U.S. Economy. The article has been published by the Associated Press News Agency. Ten months into America's viral outbreak, low-income workers are still bearing the brunt of job losses, an unusual and harsh feature of the pandemic recession that flattened the economy last spring. In December, the nation shed jobs for the first time since April. Once again, the layoffs were heavily concentrated in the industries that have suffered most because they involved the kind of face-to-face contact that is now nearly impossible. Restaurants, hotels, theaters, sports arenas, and concert halls. With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of American families unable to buy food or pay their rent. Typically in a recession, layoffs strike a broad array of industries, both those that employ higher and middle-income workers and those with lower-paid staff, as anxious consumers slash spending. Economists had worried that the same trend would emerge this time. Instead, much of the rest of the economy is healing, if slowly and fitfully. Factories, whilst not fully recovered, are cranking out goods and have added jobs even every month since May. Home sales have soared 26% from a year ago, fueled by affluent people able to work from home while looking for more space. That trend has in turn bolstered higher-paying jobs in banking, in insurance and real estate. Brad Hirschbein, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and Harry Holzer, an economist at Georgetown University, concluded in a new research paper titled "Such differences in employment loss between the highest and lowest wage workers are almost certainly unprecedented among U.S. recessions over the past 100 plus years." On the surface, the December jobs report the government issued on Friday, 10th of January, was absolutely dismal. The economy lost 140,000 jobs. It was a sixth straight month in which the hiring has slumped from the previous month. Unemployment remained stubbornly high at 6.7%. But the negative number stemmed entirely from the brutal loss, nearly 500,000 jobs lost, in a category that includes restaurants, hotels, and entertainment. State and local government also cut workers. So did hair salons and other personal services. There were layoffs too in education. Nearly every other industry added jobs. Construction gained 51,000 jobs, financial services 12,000 jobs. Transportation and warehousing companies, beneficiaries of a surge in e-commerce and delivery services amid the pandemic, gained nearly 47,000 jobs. Hirschbein said in an interview, "Job losses have definitely been very heavily concentrated in certain industries, much more so than prior recessions. Once the coronavirus vaccine becomes distributed more widely and the latest government aid packages is pumped into the economy, more analysts expect a solid recovery to kick in this summer. The incoming Biden administration, along with a now fully Democratic-led House and Senate, will also likely push additional rescue aid and spending measures that, as they claimed, could accelerate economic growth. Economists note that the $2 trillion aid package the government enacted in March, which included generous unemployment benefits and aid to small companies and businesses, did more to prevent layoffs from spending than many analysts had expected. But a big unknown overhangs the 2021 economy. Will the economic recovery come fast enough and be robust enough to absorb many of the Americans who lost their jobs in the hospitality industries into more resilient sectors of the job market? For now, the resurgent pandemic has made consumers reluctant to shop, travel, dine out, and congregate in crowds, and led states and cities to reimpose stricter limits on restaurants. the trend has upended the lives of people like Brad Pierce of West Warwick, Rhode Island, in New York. Brad Pierce had gradually built up a career as a stand-up comedian, only to see it derailed by the pandemic and restrictions in the places that he performed. Now he wonders if that life will ever return. Even when the centres where Brad Pierce worked had reopened, they couldn't offer live entertainment because of coronavirus restrictions. He fears some of these venues won't survive. Brad Pierce receives about $500 a week in unemployment aid, and his wife still works as a healthcare technician, busier than ever because she administers COVID-19 tests. Though he feels fortunate financially, the contrast sometimes depresses him. Brad Pierce, a 40-year-old, said, "She's working all the time whilst I can't work, and it's a terrible feeling as a husband and a spouse." In the meantime, there have been odd gigs for him here and there. The weirdest was a stand-up routine he did by Zoom for a company's holiday party. He asked the employees to unmute so he could hear them laughing, only to be hit by a cacophony of dogs barking, kids yelling, and television sets blaring. He spent the rest of the gig watching his audience silently, moving lips to see if they might be laughing. Brad Pierce said, "I have days where I think I will come back, and days where I think, well, I guess I'll never work again." Hirschbein and Holzer's research found that job losses have been deeper among blacks and Hispanic workers than among whites, and also more pronounced for those in lower-paying jobs. Hirschbein found employment amongst the lowest paid one-quarter Americans has sunk nearly 12% since February of this year. Among the highest paid quarter, it's declined less than 3.5%. Hirschbein said the proportion of white Americans with jobs has fallen 6% since the pandemic. Among black and Hispanic Americans, it's down 10%. This means that at some portion of the pandemic, job losses become permanent. Non-white workers will be hurt the most. Michelle Holder, an economist at John Jay College, noted that the two biggest sources of job losses amongst black women have been cashiers at stores and restaurants, including fast food outlets and in childcare. She said she fears that many of those jobs likely won't return, even as the pandemic fades away, as some shifts in the economy become permanent. Business travel won't likely return to its previous levels as more meetings are conducted remotely. Many healthcare appointments are now held online, thereby reducing the need for some staffers in doctors' offices. That may end a decades-long narrowing of the black-white unemployment gap, given that many lower-paid jobs are disproportionately held by black workers. Michelle Holder said, "There are significant changes coming in terms of where we work, what jobs will be available," she added. "All this will hit women, low-wage workers, and people of color. As the pandemic recession rages on, more small businesses have been forced to close. This trend threatens to become a long-term drag on the job market because new companies will have to be created to absorb many laid-off workers." David Gilbertson, vice president at UKG, a company that makes employee time management software, said, "Among his firm's clients with fewer than 100 employees in March, 13% have now closed, more than double the figure in a typical year." Another round of small business loans included in the $900 billion aid package approved last month will be crucial to help prevent another wave of closings. David Gilbertson said, "They've made it this far and now they're on the brink of having to close down." In the meantime, the struggling jobless include people who have forged independent careers, people like Brian Blue, who quit his job as an equipment repairman in Kansas City a year ago to become a full-time musician in Las Vegas, Nevada. Before the pandemic, Blue typically played bass guitar in bands at venues several nights a week. He isn't sure that Vegas music scene will ever return to what it was. Blue, who hasn't played a gig since March, is now wrestling with whether to give up hope of rebuilding his music career But now he's working as a delivery driver for a sandwich shop, earning $9 an hour before tips. He receives unemployment benefit depending on how much he earns with his job in a given week. Blue, a 46-year-old, said, "Time will tell, I guess. It's been a difficult pill to swallow."
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the religious men are few. Religion, particularly a religion like Islam, preserves the rights of society's people and supports their real and fair interests. However, sometimes religion is a barrier for personal and private interests of individuals. This is when those who are true to their religion are distinguished from those who only make empty claims to be religious. Most people look at things from the viewpoint of their own interests. They advocate religion when it preserves their personal rights, but when it conflicts with their private interests, they leave it totally or take a selective approach. We believe in some and disbelieve in others. This is how their attitude is. The real religious people are those few who are faithful to their religion in every situation. And religion and belief dictate their priorities in life, not personal interests. Brothers and sisters, we know that it's not easy to walk on the path defined by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam requires sacrifice. We know that. If it were not for the sacrifice, all of the prophets and imams sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have been safe living a luxurious and comfortable life. But when we look at their lives, we see that there are countless sacrifices that they have made for this religion. Now, we, unfortunately, are sometimes compelled to be selective in our approach. We're going to go for a short break, and once we come back, we're going to elaborate on this point. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the real religious men who are very few. We said that, yes, everybody likes to be religious, you know, everybody likes to have this satisfaction that they are following the religion of Islam. You know, I'm talking about Muslims. But at the same time, sometimes we feel that we are compelled enough to take a selective route, a route that does not require sacrifice. Now, if this were true, and this was like something that was desired off of us, then all of the prophets and imams should have done the same. They should have stayed in their comfort zone. They should not have sacrificed for this great religion and for this divine religion of Islam. Why is it that all of them sacrificed in one way or the other? You know, some sacrifices are too obvious, some sacrifices are not that obvious, and some sacrifices are not even known. When you look at the companions of the prophets and imams, you see the same thing. You see, like, history books are filled with their sacrifices. Why were they sacrificing? Well, the bottom line is that the religion of Islam is going to require sacrifice from each single one of us. Whether we shy away from the sacrifice or we face and embrace the sacrifice is the real test. When it's all hunky-dory, all comfortable, you're in your cozy room, you know, it comes down to praying, any Tom, Dick, and Harry can just get up and do their 2 rakat or 3 rakat or 4 units of prayers. That's not where the test is. The real test is when it comes to sacrificing something more than that. Unfortunately, for some people, even the regular prayers, they become tests. They fail that test miserably when they do not pay attention to those regular prayers. But when it comes to the real religious men, they are very few. They make sure that every time an opportunity to lay down any sacrifice for this religion comes, they don't shy away. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S., violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups will often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. 5 people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. You look at the numbers of people who were rioters who worked their way into the Capitol. This is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened to the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warned his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the vice president and the cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment, but the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That too is politically complicated and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the U.S. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major U.S. towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting the huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the U.S. government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the U.S., not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the U.S. economy.